rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. Welcome back to our program. It's the first hour of our what's actually going to be the end of the week program, as well as today's program, because I'll be on an airplane on Friday. You'll be hearing it. This is a repeat show if you're listening on Friday. On Wednesday, which is today, it is live. So here we are. And it is, so therefore, we're going to have Congressman Sanders on today, now, in our first hour, as we usually do on Friday, because this, as I said, will also be on Friday. So our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, if you'd like to weigh in on the issues of the day, if you'd like to drop into the chat room, tomhartman.com, however you spell it, we'll get you there with no problem. And Congressman Bernie Sanders in 1991 was the first independent member of Congress, elected in over 40 years. Not a Democrat, not a Republican, but an independent. He's been reelected seven times now to the House, longest-serving independent in the history of the House of Representatives, going all the way back to the George Washington administration. It's just quite a feat there, Bernie. Congratulations.
Thanks very much, Tom.
And I think of Bernie as America's congressman. He really is, in my mind, and you're doing some just extraordinary work there in the United States Congress. Bernie, what's on the front burner with you these days?
Well, Tom, I want to go over an issue which I believe is perhaps the most important domestic issue that our country faces. And that is, for ordinary Americans, the middle class, working class, lower income people, the reality is that despite working harder, despite huge increases in worker productivity, our wages for those people are going down, Meanwhile,
and have been for 20 years, by the way.
And have been
essentially
for 20
since
years,
Reagan.
And in
came
the
into
last
power.
2 years, very clearly, there has been a real decline in real inflation accounted for wages.
Yeah.
So the question that I want people to be thinking about is that at the same time as the Forbes magazine tells us there has been a huge increase in billionaires and their wealth is soaring, why is it that poverty in America is increasing? 4 million more people poor than were 4 years ago. Real wages for the middle class is going down.
Yeah.
Why is it that we are not talking about the disintegration of our health care system and the fact that we are the only nation in the industrialized world that does not guarantee health care to all people? You know, Tom, the president talks about leaving no child behind. Well, you know what? In the United States today, over 20% of our children are in poverty. Rich get richer. 20% of our kids are in poverty. We are now closing in on Mexico in terms of childhood poverty.
Yeah, and our definition of poverty in the United States, the poverty line, is in and of itself, I think, a disgrace. When you consider...
You're absolutely right.
In terms of
how you determine it,
right.
It's inadequate itself. But even under the governmental statistics, over 20% of our kids, that means these kids are not getting a fair shake. Talk to working parents throughout this country. People are going to work every day and say, can you find child care that is good quality and reasonably priced for your kids? They're going to say, no, they can't.
Yeah.
Talk to old people who can't afford prescription drugs and are suffering. Talk to families that are now trying to take care of their parents who are reaching the end of their lives and get them good quality nursing home care without seeing their entire life savings of that older person being depleted. So the question I think that we have got to focus on is, what is happening in America? Are we moving, in fact, to an oligarchy where fewer and fewer people own and control our nation, while ordinary people are seeing a decline in our standard of living? What does this mean for our kids? What kind of jobs are going to be there for our kids when we have a trade policy which is sending good-paying manufacturing jobs, good-paying information technology jobs to China, to India, to Mexico? What's going to be left for our kids? Are they going to be flipping hamburgers? How many hamburgers can we, in fact, flip? Where are going to be the decent-paying jobs that sustain a middle-class standard of living? So I think those are the issues that the middle class of this country has got to speak out on and not allow the media to deflect us to Terry Schiavo, to Michael Jackson, to all of the other celebrities. Celebrities have their problems. You know, we're all worried about Michael Jackson, but there are one or two other problems facing America that we have got to focus on.
Yeah. And number one, you're not hearing the Republican Party which controls the House, the Senate, the White House, and the Supreme Court. You're not hearing them talk about any of these issues at all.
Not in a million years. And the only times that they do address these issues is to make a bad situation worse. Yes, they will talk about our trade policy, not to protect American jobs, but to make it easier for corporations to send our jobs abroad. We're now looking at CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, which will only make what NAFTA did even worse, the loss of good-paying jobs. These are the people who are cutting back on the overtime pay that workers get. They're privatizing good-paying jobs that governmental workers have. They haven't raised the minimum wage. Millions of American workers trying to get by on $5.15 an hour. These guys have nothing to say about raising the minimum wage. But I have to say, they do stay up nights worrying about more tax breaks for the richest people in this country and for the largest corporations. They do worry about that a whole lot.
Bernie, just a practical kind of human-to-human question here. How do these folks justify this? What is the rationale that the Grover Norquists and the George W. Bushes and the Tom DeLays and of the world have what do they say to themselves when they're going to sleep at night that allows them to sleep after they've voted against an increase in the minimum wage or they've stacked the Department of Labor with anti-labor people what possible rationale do they have? They must believe that they're doing something good. I just can't believe that they're evil people.
Well, Tom, you know a great deal about psychology and how the human mind works, and people can delude themselves that they are doing the right thing. You start off with the fact that you surround yourself with wealthy campaign contributors, and you spend a lot of the times in the country club and being wined and dined by the wealthy and powerful. And they all say, hey, you're doing a great job. Things are going great. Keep up the fine work. So that, number one, your circle of acquaintances affirms what you are doing. And second of all, you build a phony ideology. And the ideology is, look, we don't want the government protecting the needs of working people. What's really best, what freedom is really about, is every person for themselves. So we're going to privatize Social Security and Medicare and make people freer so they could not live under the burdens of government oppression. And you can develop a rationale for that as well.
Yeah.
And I think that's that ends up being the combination of things that makes
it's kind of a combination of
do.
And the fact that many of these people were actually born into great wealth. And
some of them certainly. I mean, you have a president who went to Exeter High School. Who's a millionaire family. You have, I don't know what it is now, maybe a third of the United States Senate who are millionaires. More and more members of Congress are millionaires. People who run for office write a check out to themselves. Hey, here's $1 million for myself. So they really have no sense of reality in terms of what goes on with the middle class. They fly around in private jets. They live in guarded, big fancy houses. They send their kids to Harvard and Yale. Healthcare is not a problem for them because they have the best healthcare in the world that money can buy. And I think what you are increasingly seeing is a separation in the realities of members of Congress and of the White House from what ordinary people really go through on a day-to-day.
It really is the two Americas that John Edwards
is
talking about. Yeah. So which brings up my second question, and that is, what can average people do about this?
Tom, average people can do, I mean, what people cannot accept is that politics is just voting once every 2 years or once every 4 years. That's certainly important, and I urge all the listeners to take an active role in elections. But politics, as our right-wing Republican friends know, is much more than once every 2 or 4 years. It's 365 days a year. Everybody who is listening to this show has friends and family members. They can write to their member of Congress, get on the phone. The phone numbers are all in the phone books, and say, look, we have 30 or 40 people who are coming out, and we want to schedule a meeting with you to talk about our concerns about our disastrous trade policy, the disintegration of our healthcare system, the need to raise the minimum wage, the need for legislation to protect workers, kids, the elderly, and so forth and so on. Go on the offensive. Don't just wait to 2 weeks before an election when, your member of Congress wants to talk to you. You have the right to talk to him or her today, tomorrow. Do that. Let's break through the old-fashioned, people forget about that. They are the ones who hire members of Congress and the president. It's not the other way around.
And what do you do if you call your member of Congress's office or your member of the Senate?
This is what I would suggest.
And you get a glad hand response. Yes, thank you very much.
Not necessarily. You say, you know, and be polite, of course, and understand that members of Congress have tough schedules. They're running all over the place. They're in Washington a lot. But say, look, we want to schedule at a mutually convenient time a meeting with you. And we're going to have 50 or 100 people out or more, and you have to do that. You have to bring people out. And here's a letter from, you know, signed by 30 or 40 people or whatnot. We want to sit down, talk to you, Congressperson. These are our concerns, and we look forward to seeing you at the local school, church, wherever it may be, and let us discuss with you our issues of concern. And dear Congressperson, if you don't have time for us, please save your postage when election time comes, because we may not have time for you at that point.
Yeah.
That's all polite, but firm. Get out the issues that you want to discuss, and people want to discuss different issues. But in other words, it is absolutely important for the people of this country to understand that Congress is supposed to represent them and not just the wealthy and the powerful. They have a right to make demands, polite demands, upon members of Congress. Hold them accountable.
Do you think that one of the issues that when people contact their members of Congress, they should be pushing the hardest might be campaign finance reform and changing the system in such a way that, that members of Congress aren't feeling so beholden to these large corporations?
Absolutely. Certainly campaign finance reform is a huge issue. No question about that. And until we break our dependency on big money contributions and all of the loopholes that currently exist, it's hard to imagine having a Congress that represent the middle class and working class
in
this country.
And of course,
but people should feel, you know, Tom, in different regions of the country, there'll be different issues and different, you know, concerns.
Sure.
People just have got to go on the offensive and take their issues to members of Congress.
Right. Whether it's the minimum wage or whether it's rigged voting machines. I mean, whatever they're...
Whatever it may be. Different folks will have different issues, and that's fine. But your member of Congress, you know, understanding that he or she has a schedule, can't, you know, come in 5 minutes, but there's no reason why members of Congress should not be sitting down and talking to constituents about their concerns.
Yeah. I'm curious, Bernie. You represent about 650,000 people, the state of Vermont.
Right.
And back when I used to live in Georgia 10, 15 years ago, I was in Newt Gingrich's district, and he represented, I think, around 900,000 people at that time. I was in Cobb County. And I wonder how... How often do, out of the 650,000 people who you represent, how often do they actually call your office or contact you? I mean, is this a relatively rare thing?
No, it's not a relatively rare thing, and it depends. It's often on issues. If something is hot in the media, hotly debated in Congress, we will get a whole lot of calls.
Yeah.
I remember years ago during the Clinton impeachment, my God, we had everybody in our office on the phone answering the phone calls.
Yeah.
And sometimes it quiets down. But we get a lot of calls. And I, as Vermont's congressman, really do try to get out. We hold many, many, many town meetings. We're going to be holding a town meeting, in fact, at the State House at 2 o'clock on Saturday on veterans issues, because we know many veterans are concerned about the disastrous budget that Bush has presented, which would cut back on health care for our veterans. So we got out to the communities a whole lot.
20 minutes after.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush Show, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 24 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Our brunch with Bernie, Congressman Bernie Sanders, is with us today for this entire hour. Our telephone number 1-866-889-8894. If you'd like to be on with Congressman Sanders, Buddha in Cameo, Colorado, on the line. Am I pronouncing all that right, Buddha?
Well, it's called Cameo.
Cameo.
But,
okay. There you go.
But I appreciate it. And as always, I'd like to pass my compliments on to you for your show, as well as especially for having Congressman Sanders on. And as always, my compliments to Congressman Sanders. I hear you, Congressman. We've got to fight this trend, this poison that's spreading throughout the land. But, you know, I mean, I vote. I do everything that you're talking about. I also assault right-wing talk shows. I send letters to the editor. I send emails to major media outlets, emails to sponsors. just what else can I do?
Well, first of all, I wish a few million other people did what you do, Buddha. That's fantastic. I mean, you're an activist, and you're making your point of view known. I think what I would suggest, what is a good tactic, is if you can assemble some people together to invite your member of Congress to sit down with you to listen to the concerns that you and your fellow citizens have, and to hold that member of Congress accountable on those issues, that would be a very positive thing to do as well. I think sometimes progressives forget that they have the right to make demands, respectful demands, of their members of Congress and hold them accountable. That would be one suggestion.
How's it?
My problem with that is whenever I try to talk to people, they say, yeah, we agree with you, Buddha, but I've got to do this, I've got to do that, and they, you know, the apathy.
That's frustrating me. And you're right, but sometimes it's not just apathy. People are working so hard they don't have the time. But I think you're going to have to, you know, do some things. Maybe, you know, I don't know how to do it. You know, just have a little social gathering. But figure out a way that you can bring people together and invite your elected representatives to answer the questions of the people.
The key is
I know it's not so easy, but that would be one suggestion that I would have.
The key, Buddha, I'd
keep
say
up the great job that you're doing there, Buddha. It sounds great.
Yeah, and I would say take the initiative. You know,
that's right.
In other words, go to a local church or a local high school or whatever and say, can I book the auditorium for 5 weeks from Friday or whatever? And you know, call Congress. Congress is always out on Friday, right, Bernie? You guys are generally back home?
Not always.
Often. Okay, or make it a Saturday, for example, Saturday night.
You know what you could do? You could throw in some pancakes, too.
Yeah, and put on an event and then say, okay, here's the event. I mean, you could even give your group a name, you know, the Committee for Information on the Minimum Wage Reform or whatever. And sometimes names catch people's eye. And then go to your friends and say, hey, I've got the hall. You know, we've got the pancakes. You just have to show up. You're going to show up, you know, 5 weeks from now on Saturday. And then you contact your member of Congress and you make it happen. You get out there and knock on doors and make it happen.
Putting on a social event where people can eat, have a good time, and invite a member of Congress.
Yeah.
I think it's a good step.
Might even want to have a bar there. Maybe not. Judy in Michigan on the line. Hey, Judy, welcome to the program.
Hi. I missed you yesterday because I had to go to the doctor, so I got you today, Tom.
Well, that's great, and I believe yesterday's show is going to be repeated tomorrow because we're going to be moving out to the West Coast, and so
you'll get to hear the program you missed. Really, then.
There you go.
Yeah, but I want to talk to the congressman because I am a senior, and I am concerned. I watch C-SPAN sometimes, and what is Congress going to do about us seniors in health care and prescription coverage next year? I mean, we're not rich. And it's from the letter I got a few months ago. Next year is really going to be rough on us. And like the other caller, you know, I've called the one here in Michigan and talked to him, you know, and people just don't want to do it. All they want to do is complain about it, but they don't want to do anything, you know, get in there and be involved.
Yeah, Judy, I'm going to have to ask Bernie to answer that right after this break, but it's a great question, and thank you for asking. It's a very important question, Judy.
We'll answer it after the break.
Yeah, we'll get right to that. It's 29 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, 1-866-889-8894, our toll-free number. And we shall return shortly.
Ever wonder who coined the phrase, we eliminate the middle?
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, at least not the Republicans.
Turn around and walk away.
No, good. Move in their direction. Get active, as Congressman Sanders is recommending. Bernie, you wanted to respond to Judy's question. What a great question she asked.
Yeah, Judy asked what Congress is doing or not doing with senior citizens. That is a really great question because so many seniors in our country are just having a hard, very hard time making ends meet. And what I have to say, Judy, unfortunately, is this particular president and leadership in Congress are much more concerned about the needs of the insurance companies and the drug companies than they are about the needs of seniors. The president's proposal to privatize Social Security will be a disaster for people, for seniors in the future. We'll reach retirement age. Benefits will be cut substantially, even with the private accounts, if, God forbid, that should pass. The prescription drug program that they passed at 5 o'clock in the morning 2 years ago will cost taxpayers of this country huge amounts of money, and yet a year or two after the program's implementation, seniors will be paying more out of their own pocket despite that huge federal investment, because that particular program was written by the pharmaceutical industry. There's an effort to privatize Social Security rather than strengthen the guarantees that Social Security now provides. So I wish I could give Judy better news, but the reality is that this administration and the Republican leadership in many ways are at war against senior citizens in this country.
So couldn't we say, Bernie, that the bottom line kind of straightforward answer for Judy is, number one, keep on them, no matter what. Keep on them, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. And number two,
absolutely,
if you have a member of Congress who is not responding to your needs and wants, and they're not, you know, voting in your interests, join whatever it takes. You know, Democracy for America, the Democratic Party, the Greens, the local Voters League. What, you know, get together with other people, get out there, get active, go door to door, wake people up, tell your friends, forward emails. You start now, because an election is coming up in a year and a half, and I'm telling you, the Republicans are already designing their strategy right now to
absolutely. And Tom, it's not just, you know, Republicans; it's Democrats too.
Yeah,
you know,
conservative Democrats. Absolutely.
Absolutely. People need to know and be familiar with how their members of Congress are voting and stand on the important issues. The bottom line here is this country has enormous wealth and enormous capabilities, and just as we should not have 20% of our kids living in poverty, we should not have seniors not able to afford the prescription drugs that they need, not have seniors have to deplete their life savings in order to get into a nursing home. We can do a lot better than that.
Yeah, well
and,
said.
People are going to have to get involved in the process to make that happen.
Yep, and we need to keep people, and we need to hold our representatives accountable.
Absolutely.
And if they're not going to be accountable, we need to replace them. And
that's right.
And that's us. That's we the people, us, we the individuals. We're the ones who have to do it. Let's go back. The phone lines are all lit up here. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, John in New York on the line. Hey, John.
Hi, how are you today?
Great.
Okay, I have a question for the congressman. Last night, my brother got locked up on a warrant for a suspended driving license. He'll be there only 2 days. But my point is, he tried calling my house collect and my cell phone collect. There's a company out there that blocks prisoners from making collect calls and then forces you to set up an account using your Social Security number and using a credit card so that you can free up your line for collect calls. Is that normal?
John, my understanding is, and it probably depends state by state, so I'm not an expert on this, but my understanding is that there are private companies who are really ripping off prisoners right now, trying to really gouge them for the calls that they're making, and I think that probably has something to do with what you're talking about.
What if somebody's, like, very low income, which we're not, but still, somebody who can't afford or doesn't have a credit card, those people have no communication, if they're on charges that aren't violent or anything like that?
That's right. That may well be the case. I mean, I think what happens is sometimes the state gives out these contracts in order to make money for the state, which then rip off prisoners. I would call up, were you in New York State?
Yes.
Call up the Department of Corrections and find out what's going on there.
Yeah. I call them up. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And
okay,
also,
take care, John.
And also let your member of Congress and your senators know what you think of it. And this is also symptomatic of the widespread privatization of prison. What do you call it? Holding. I mean, you know, just the warehousing of people here in the United States. One of the fastest growing.
And making a profit making.
That's right. This is one of the fastest growing industries in America. Is the private prison industry, and that's a scary thing. That's another rant for another time. Let's get back to the phones here. Chuck in Los Alamos, New Mexico, on the line. Hey, Chuck, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks very much, and thank you, Congressman, for what you're doing.
Thank you.
My concern is this. We hosted an event, as you suggested, Mr. Sanders, for Senator Jeff Bingaman. And when we expressed our issues, what we heard, and obviously he's, you know, a Democrat and in the minority, basically what we got back was, well, there's nothing I can do. And I wanted desperately. I mean, I told him when they were bringing, you know, Condoleezza Rice and the rest of these fascists into the administration, I said, well, can you filibuster? Can you do, I mean, something, anything? Can you, like, at least stand up and express your dismay at these people? And what I've been getting from my congressman and also from my senator is they can't do anything. So what do I do when they can't do anything?
Okay, well, the answer is it is absolutely true that the Congress is today controlled by right-wing Republicans who call the tunes. They are the ones who will determine what pieces of legislation get voted on and so forth and so on. The rules in the Senate are different than in the House. But you do have a right. Having said that, that doesn't make any member of Congress impotent. They have the right to introduce legislation. They have the right to fight. They have the right to go out and hold political views and rally the American people and the people in their state. They have the absolute obligation to be in the center of the struggle to defeat Bush and his agenda. So you have every right in the world to make demands on members of Congress and in the Senate to be as progressive, forceful, and aggressive as they can be. On the other hand, if they tell you, hey, we can't change the world tomorrow, we are in the minority, there's truth to that, too. But you have the right to demand that they make the best fight that they can so that we can change what goes on in this country.
But at what point, Bernie, and Chuck also, at what point do you say, okay, Jeff Bingaman is a Democrat, mm-hmm. he's a fairly decent guy, but he's not Paul Wellstone. He's not somebody who's really, truly out there as a progressive and really fighting the fight. But he's not evil, right? So at what point do you decide to challenge somebody like that, knowing that that might end up actually weakening the Democratic Party and weakening a guy who's okay, which would cause a Republican to come in who's actually destructive? I mean, at what point do you say, okay, that's it, no more help from me, you're too lukewarm, I'm going to go with the Greens or whatever, you know, at what point?
Well, Tom, I think that's a decision that folks back home in every district have got to make, and they have to look at their own circumstances.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I can't speak for 435 districts. What I can say, though, is that given the fact that so many politicians are dependent upon big money and so forth, to the degree that ordinary people get mobilized and are willing to stand up, it's easier for elected officials to do the right thing if they know that there's a groundswell of support behind them. One of the problems that some good people in Congress have, they say, hey, if I do the right thing, I'm going to get killed by the big money interest. Nobody back home is supporting me. Why should I stick my neck out?
So there you go, Chuck. At some point, you've got to make some decisions, number one. Or number two, maybe if you can get involved with Bingaman in helping him raise local money, you know, doing some website stuff, something like that. If that would push him more progressive. You know, I don't know. He's not my senator. But, I mean, these are the tough choices.
But you said the right thing. I mean, the man is a good guy. He really is. I think he's telling me the truth, that there's nothing he can do. But we got to do something.
But, no, that's not true. It is fair for any member of Congress, for me or Bingaman and anybody else, to say, look, I can't pass that legislation. They won't even let it on the floor of the House. That's true. But on the other hand, you don't sit back. You have to change the terrain. You have to mobilize people. You have to reach out to conservatives, to working class people who are voting against their own best interests. Is he doing that aggressively enough? There are a lot of things, believe me, that people should be doing.
Yeah, and if he's not, then you give him hell. We got to move along. Chuck, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Tom in St. Paul, Minnesota on the line. Hey, Tom.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bernie.
Hi.
Hey, Tom, you covered yesterday that email I sent you from the banker on...
Yeah, thank you for that.
Good,
thank you.
Good. I forgot to put on there also LBJ's public broadcasting. What would we do without that, right?
Yeah, please. Yeah.
Two things, Bernie, real quick. Two of the most important things I think we need to cover is ballot integrity and I have some ideas on how we can get active and get on the offensive. Of course, our ballot is the cornerstone. We got to stay on this thing. We can talk till we're blue in the face. If our vote means nothing,
right.
What is this all about, right?
So
we got to get on that. And going on the offensive, last election, I noticed since public radio is being inundated by right-wing think tank guests and right-wing drones that call in spewing the propaganda. So what I've done, I'm constantly just hovering and monitoring the public radio, both Minnesota and Wisconsin, and I call in to fight back this stuff. Last week I had to call and challenge a guy who was spewing crap about how the raising the minimum wage would hurt workers, and I, of course, challenged him on that and ran off all the facts. And then this morning, a guy calls in saying, well, we ought to have a show about capitalism, how capitalism saved America as it related to the pilgrims and how their communal living was a disaster. So I called and I said, no, we should have a program on how democracy saved capitalism from the Republican Great Depression, in particular FDR and we the people.
Well done.
Elected him four times. So it's democracy. Yeah. Anyway, and I, of course, quoted Lincoln, but we have to
Well done, Tom. Do you have a question specifically for Bernie?
Well, for Bernie, here for the listeners, you got to call the public radio programs because I've noticed they have unleashed listeners and the Heritage Foundation, all these cranks to get on public radio, and we need to...
Well, Tom, let me just jump in. I mean, your point is absolutely right, and congratulations again to you for doing the right thing. But in addition to that, people have can sit down with the CEO of your local or statewide public radio and talk to him or her about programming. What we do know that's going on, certainly with public television, it's moving to the right.
Yeah.
The Bush administration has appointed people to the national public television who are much more conservative. You're seeing now some right-wing shows on public television. It put on in a way that was never the case before, really injected from the administration. You have a right to sit down with listener-supported radio and television, tell them what you think should be on the air. Fight back.
Yeah, and certainly, I got to tell you, Bernie, I've tried that here in Vermont without success. I couldn't even get the guy to return my phone calls.
Really?
Yeah.
Well,
and you don't want to hear the whole sorry story, but you know, that people need, and finally, I sent them a letter saying, I'm not sending you guys any more money,
right.
And here's why. And, you know, whether that's going to produce any change or not, I don't know. We'll see. Anyhow, let's go to Dave in Humboldt County, California. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Gentlemen, I much appreciate all that you both do, and I know that you have both been very guarded and cautious and are not quick to leap to what sounds like conspiracy tin hat theories. But I hear from both of you, I think you are much, much more aware today that a group of criminals planned to steal our government, and they did it through a fraudulent election process. So now we are faced with that reality. They still have these damn machines, totally riggable, I believe that Kerry won by almost 60% of the vote, and they were able to transfer that many votes on these trick machines. That's the key to everything, getting them gone. You're the guy that can do it, I think, Bernie. You have the kind of a voice if you see clearly what's happening there. This goes back to PNAC. They planned this a dozen years ago.
Jim Bernie?
Yeah, Bernie.
Yeah. Did you want to respond? I know you're a co-sponsor, Rush Holt's legislation, to end
to clean up the voting machine mess. And Tom, you know, Tom Hartman has done a great job in writing about this issue and talking about it. No question, that we need to make absolutely certain, as somebody said earlier, voting is the cornerstone of our democracy, and if people do not believe that their vote is going to be counted, we're not living in a democracy.
Yeah.
So we need to have paper trails. We're working on that right here in the Congress. Also, there are a number of states that are going forward on their own. State secretaries of state have the power to implement this. Legislatures have the power to implement this. So let's go forward and make sure that when you vote, your vote is counted. There's a paper trail recording how you voted, so if there's a recount, we know what where we're at.
Although the irony, I don't know if you're aware of it, in California, the Secretary of State had kicked out Diebold, you know, and banned the voting machines because he found all these problems. Well, then he gets kicked out, and now Schwarzenegger is going to put in a guy who's got links to the voting machine companies. And so it's like it gets weirder every day. Anyhow, we'll move along. Jeff in Atlanta on the line. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program. 1-866-889-8894, by the way.
I know, Bernie, that Tom has said in the past, actually said to me yesterday, that he agrees that the election was indeed stolen, specifically in Ohio. And I mean, so we can talk about trying to prevent that in 2006.
But let me qualify that, Jeff, by saying I think the election could have been stolen in Ohio. I'm not sure that it was stolen by voting machines. I just think all the shenanigans that Ken Blackwell did in Ohio were enough, frankly.
It's not just the voting machines, but that in a combination with all the things that you just mentioned. Yeah. But the fact of the matter is, the 100-page report that came out about all this, I paid attention, and it seems, you know, 99.9% clear that it is a fact that they stole it. Not to mention this weekend, those statisticians from Utah did a study that said the 1 in a million chance that the exit polls were wrong. So my point is, how come Barbara Boxer and another lady, the only two there standing and protesting. And what would have happened if everyone got together and said, no, it's a fact, this was stolen, we're not going to take it? Why didn't that happen, and why is it too late to say,
well, for a couple of reasons.
Do-over.
Number one, everyone, the majority of the people in Congress are Republicans. So it's not terribly likely that you're going to have a majority of the people get together and say, gee, we stole the election. I don't think that's going to happen. Number two, there are differences of opinion on the issue. I think there's no question that in Ohio there were waiting lines that went on for hours. Votes were lost. But as I said on the show before, John Kerry himself did not think that he won Ohio. So, yeah.
And that's ultimately, you know, he was the guy running, and that's the biggest roadblock for me, frankly, is that he didn't stand up for himself. So, although we had John Conyers on this show, and I mean, what they found there was absolutely horrifying, Bernie. I'm sure you've talked with him about it.
Yeah.
Anyhow, we gotta take a break. We'll be back. Our number 1-866-889-8894. Congressman Bernie Sanders on the Tom Hartman Program. 10 minutes before the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is a small computer company.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour, it's the Tom Hartman radio program, Brunch with Bernie. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Bernie, in our chat room, somebody just posted a note. Tom, in Italy, we just had regional elections and the vote was done on paper, and exit polls tell you immediately who won. Why can't we have that in the United States? And I just toss it out. You know.
Well, there are a number of communities in Vermont that still have paper ballots.
They
think the work
does fine. We do that. Okay, great. Let's go back to the phone lines. We've got a bunch of calls. James in Houston, Texas. Hey, James.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on what people could do. I'm just thinking, you know, there was some of the unions went out and protested in front of the financial companies.
That's right.
That's right.
You know, we need to be going after the people that are funding this stuff.
Yeah, and
you're exactly right. And you know what? It worked in a number of instances.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And
it was successful.
And the AFL-CIO has a new, if you're not a member of a union, you can still participate. I'm forgetting what it's called, their website, but if AFL-CIO.org will get you to it.
You know, we need to be taking the pressure off of our elected representatives, you know, and the way to do that is to go to the source.
Yeah, and pardon me, I interrupted you, Bernie. You were going to finish a sentence.
Well, James is right. What happened is a lot of these big financial groups that stand to make huge sums of money through the privatization of Social Security have been contributing money to efforts, to advertising, and so forth to push Bush's plan. And the union started protesting that, and some of these financial investment companies have backed off. It's been quite a successful effort.
That's great. Let's go to Florian in Arlington Heights, Illinois. Hey, Florian.
Yes, hi. With regards to Bernie's request for town hall meetings, is there any reason why every town hall meeting should not address the fiscal responsibility or irresponsibility that we're currently engulfed with?
Absolutely. That's certainly one of the major issues. We have record-breaking deficits, over $400 billion, $7 trillion in national debt, and this president wants to give more and more tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country. I think it's a major issue, and that certainly should be an issue that people talk about.
Okay. And Lynn in Eureka, California, we've got about 15 seconds, Lynn.
Oh, I don't think that's going to be enough time.
Okay. Well, in that case, I'll put you on hold. I'm sorry. Bernie, just to wrap up, a few final words about what people should be doing.
I think the main thing is people have got to not only be active, talk to people who do not agree with you on every issue. Talk to workers and ask them, if they vote Republican, do they think it's a good idea that the CEOs of large corporations sell American workers out, take our jobs to China, and then bring the products back into this country?
There you go.
Talk about civil liberties. Form some good coalitions. Put pressure on Congress.
Get active.
That's the word.
Despair is not an option. Thank you, Congressman Bernie Sanders. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll see you again next Friday.
Okay, Tom. Take care.
Great. Have a good one. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
If it...
The man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. Just a... Every now and then, I run across one of these things that have absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with politics, but are so useful, I think it's important to share with you. And this one in today's newspaper, a story in the Associated Press, just as an FYI, because this is something I think all parents are concerned about. And, you know, thank goodness most parents don't struggle with this, but certainly all parents are concerned about it. And having been the parent of three kids, I still am the parent of three kids. I mean, this was never an issue for any of my kids, as far as I know. But nonetheless, this is something that without any further ado, here's the story from the Associated Press by Lindsay Tanner. Asking teenagers about suicide will not make them more likely to contemplate it, as some parents and school officials fear, a study suggests. The study found that simply asking troubled students about suicidal impulses appears to actually ease their distress and might make some of them less likely to try killing themselves. So this is a pretty important study. 7 million kids a year try suicide in the United States. About 1,600 succeed. Most of those are really calls for attention or help. Some are serious efforts, but... This new study shows that if you actually bring up the topic with your children, you will actually diminish the probability of their actually following through with some sort of a suicide attempt. In the previous hour, while we were talking with Bernie Sanders, one of the folks in our chat room mentioned that there were elections in Italy last week, which brings us to our Berlusconi alert for this week. Yes. He's the guy. A small-time crook and entrepreneur. His business partner just went to prison, so I think I can legitimately call him a crook, who bought a TV station and then bought a radio station and then bought another radio station and then bought a newspaper and then bought another TV station and then bought a radio network and then bought another TV network and then bought another radio network. And pretty soon he owned all the radio networks and all the TV networks and most of the newspapers in Italy. Everything except the equivalent, the Italian equivalent of BBC or NPR, he owned it all. And then he decided to run for office, and guess what? He won! Silvio Berlusconi, the current prime minister of Italy, where they had to actually pass a law saying that he couldn't be prosecuted while he was in office, because the government was so embarrassed by his crimes. This is what would happen if Rupert Murdoch were to run for office in the United States. It's a solo mio. Yeah, he owns the whole thing, all the media in Italy. Well, eventually, even when you own all the media in a country, the people figure it out. Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, this from the Swiss Info, a news service out of Switzerland. Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi suffered a crushing defeat at Italian regional elections. Official results showed on Monday a huge boost for center-left leader Romano Prodi's hopes of unseating him next year. In what one of his defeated regional governors described as a massacre, Berlusconi's center-right coalition appeared to have lost 11 of the 13 regions at stake, holding on to just two, Lombardy and Veneto, both in its stronghold to the north. Berlusconi had prepared his supporters for a poor result, saying he expected a midterm backlash due to Italy's economic woes. They're practicing. See, he's been inflicting conservative economics on them, too. But the outcome was far worse than expected. Could this be the end for Silvio? One can only hope. One by one, the right wingers are falling. Spain now has woken up. Italy next, maybe on May 5th, even the United Kingdom. 11 minutes after the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Lots of fascinating stuff in the news here. And George Bush has finally come out and revealed the dirty little secret about Social Security that's not being discussed. And what's amazing to me is the American press didn't even pick up on it. This is probably the biggest story of the year. And Bush handed it to them on a silver platter, and they didn't even pick up on it. We'll get to that in just a minute. First, let's go to the phone lines, 1-866-889-8894. And Lynn in Eureka, California. Hey, Lynn, what's up?
I recently met. First off, I want to tell you, you've been really on here the last few days. Your show is exceptionally good here recently.
Well, thank you. It must be the coffee I've been drinking.
I met with a group that's trying to get IRV, some form of IRV, installed in Humboldt County. And we've run into a roadblock there putting in voting machines, devolved machines. And they're telling us that the source code has to be Diebold's. It has to be their property, according to the Help America Vote Act, and that they also have to have these machines because in the same act it requires them to do that to help the disabled to vote.
Yeah, well, the voting machine companies have gotten together this disabled coalition, as it were, and there's a lot of questions about, you know, where the money's going and who's really involved and whether it represents really people with disabilities or not, and all this, just, you know, it's getting ugly. And so there is this, whether it's a front group or a legitimate group or not, frankly, I don't honestly know. I mean, I've read stories on both sides of this saying we have to have voting machines to protect the rights of the disabled. And certainly we want to protect the rights of the disabled. Absolutely. Whether or not the Help America Vote Act mandates that the source code of the software in the machines be owned by the companies that are providing the machines, I frankly don't know. What I do know is that Jimmy Carter and, excuse me while I relax the muscles of my throat so I can say this, James Baker III, are heading up a commission to look at the Help America Vote Act. Because, as we all know, this legislation was passed in 2002, after the debacle, or 2001 rather, after the debacle in 2000 in Florida to try to, quote, prevent another Florida from happening. And what it did was it made things much worse. It's basically they took $4 billion of our tax money. I think it's $3.4 billion, actually, a little less than $4 billion of our tax money. And they gave it to the states in grants and said, okay, you can use this money to buy voting machines from these big voting machine companies that just happen to be run by Republicans and affiliated with the Republican Party. And you know, the Republican Congress, the Republican Senate, Republican President, everybody was all behind this, and won't this be wonderful? And now we've got this mess. And my hope is that this commission actually does something and does something quickly. Although I wouldn't bet a plug nickel on it. In the meantime, yeah, we all need to be harassing our elected officials, as I do Bernie regularly when he gets on this program, about, you know, let's do something about this. And, of course, he actually is doing it. He's a co-sponsor of the legislation to change that. And so the answer to your question is, number one, I don't know. But if the Help America Vote Act requires that, that's something that's outrageous and all the more reason to just blow that thing out of the water. Frankly, I'd be surprised if it was that explicit.
Yeah,
but you can get a copy of the, you know, thomas.loc.gov, the Library of Congress, thomas.loc.gov. You can find the Help America Vote Act and read it, and it'll tell you.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. I had another little comment. Hope this doesn't upset you. You and Bernie on occasion have mentioned that Kerry was not interested in recounting Ohio because it makes kind of a roadblock because it was his election. Well, you know, that was our election. Yeah. I voted for the lesser of two evils, and I expect that lesser of two evils to stand up for.
I do too. I do too. And I felt very let down by John Kerry, frankly, and that is a feeling that has not left me. The whole thing left a bad taste in my mouth. I suspect that he thought that the political equation was don't be a spoiler, and he can come back in 2008.
And he can come back, yeah.
And I think that he has absolutely shot himself in the foot. I think he had no idea how outraged the
electorate
was.
I won't vote for him again. I admired him before.
Yeah, same here. That's it. John Kerry had his chance with me, and unless he wants to call his program and convince me as to why I should support him, it's not going to happen. But there is a certain amount of reality to the fact that under the law in the state of Ohio and in many states, under the law of the state of Ohio, if that election was to be contested, you couldn't do it and I couldn't do it even if we lived in Ohio. The candidates had to do it.
Yes.
And so we saw the situation where these incredibly brave candidates, the David Cobb of the Green Party and Michael Badnarik of the Libertarian Party, went and challenged the election and raised hundreds of thousands of dollars on the internet from those of us who really cared about this.
Yes.
And then we saw Ken Blackwell running around and fudging the recount. I mean, the recount wasn't even done clean.
Yes.
And through the whole thing, Kerry was, what we were hearing from his brother Cam was, well, he's concerned about this. He's looking into this. We've got our lawyers on the ground. I didn't hear anything that meant anything to me. I'm sorry. Call me a cynic. Call me a wacko conspiracy nut. Whatever you want. I don't care. I would have liked to have seen him fight for the integrity of our vote. As Thomas Paine said, the beating heart of a democratic republic is the vote. If you take away a man's right to vote, you have reduced him to being a servant of tyranny.
Yeah.
And it's just that simple. And in my opinion, Kerry just obviously I agree with you. We can't blame it on Kerry entirely. But Ken Blackwell, this is a guy who we need to have some serious criminal investigations into what's going on in the state of Ohio. And then you get these lawyers, Bob Fratakis and the other three from freepress.org, great website, www.freepress.org, who challenge him. And what does he do? The attorney general for the state of Ohio, whose name escapes me at the moment, but he's also partisan Republican, him and Blackwell, they sue these guys. It's like a slap suit. It's like a harassment suit. And so now you've got these lawyers that are like, just average guys, and facing huge legal bills to defend the fact that they had the audacity to stand up and say to our public officials, hey, why don't you prove to us that this election was actually clean? I mean, isn't there an obligation to prove to us that there was something clean about
this
election?
They're very blatant about this. They don't care what we...
Oh, I know. It's like, the press went to Ken Blackwell before the election when he was doing the, it's got to be on 80-pound paper, and we're gonna purge the voting list of the felons, and we're going to move some of these machines into the white Republican districts and get... And somebody came to him and said, people are going to remember you like Catherine Harris, and all he did was he smiled and he said, Catherine Harris got a seat in Congress.
Yeah.
And now he's running for governor, and they're putting together this patriot pastor bunch in Ohio. They're trying to get a million people in churches now in Ohio registered to vote through these patriot pastors, so that they can next time they won't have to rig the machines or whatever. It's just absolutely off the wall. Lynn, thanks for getting me started. We'll take a couple more calls, then I want to get back to this thing about George Bush revealing the real problem with Social Security. Right after this. It's 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Love is a burning thing.
It's Johnny Cash.
And it makes a fiery ring.
Bound and welcome back, my friends.
Wild desire.
Tom Hartman here with you. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. First, let's go to Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, what's happening in the big city?
Three in
interesting things today, Tom. The first one is that the Treasury Department held its radio day to talk about Social Security, and they had the likes of Karl Rove and the Treasury Secretary there and all those folks. They're still trying to make the case. And what's so amazing is you can ask them any question. You know, I asked them a question of like, I asked Karl Rove, Karl, how would you kind of heal the divide in this country? Well, the president's trying to do this by talking about hard issues like Social Security. I mean, no matter... These people have their message. It's amazing.
The president is trying to heal the divide in the country by going around the country and having events where you can only get in if you're a registered Republican, and if you have a No Blood for Oil sticker on your car, they will drag your butt out of there and beat you to the ground.
Right. You got it.
That's good healing.
So that's the first thing. The other interesting thing is, of course, as the stuff on delay mounts up, around the money for his daughter and his wife, and as another trip to Russia comes out, one by the New York Times story, one by the Washington Post today, Republicans are almost thinking like they're going to close ranks like they did with Bill Clinton. As you know, I've always said if Bill Clinton if the right wing had not come after Bill Clinton from the day he got in office, when the Monica thing came out, I think the Democrats would have gone against him. But they just felt it was a continuing attack, and so the Democrats closed ranks. It would not be surprising if that doesn't happen with the Republicans as well, from what I am hearing.
So by closing ranks, you mean all the Republicans are going to get together and support Tom DeLay and say, that's it, we're digging our heels in, he may be a bum, but he's our bum?
We're hearing some ripples of that.
Yeah.
And the third thing is that foreign relations may, in fact, postpone the Josh Bolton hearings, to be ambassador to the United Nations.
Oh, maybe the audio clips are getting around of Bolton dissing the UN?
Well, they're certainly thinking of postponing the hearing, so we don't know what that's about.
Well, that's quite interesting. How much play? Now, the Washington Post had one story about DeLay, and that was about his Russia trip, as I recall. And the New York Times had the one about his wife and his daughter making $500,000 on his payroll. And then there's this whole thing with Jack Abramoff. Do you think that the average American is getting this, or is this an inside the beltway story?
I don't think that they're getting the Abramoff stuff. It's a little complex, and it's kind of interesting because I report for a station in Guam. I've reported there for almost 12 years, and they love Abramoff down there. They think that this is just terribly unfair because I guess Abramoff has brought a lot of business to them.
Yeah, he's a lobbyist.
So I guess it kind of depends on your perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, and has there been any blowback at all? I mean, yesterday we saw this merger between Chevron, Condi Rice's old company, it had a tanker named after her, the Condoleezza Rice, and Unocal, who Hamid Karzai was the consultant to Unocal. Unocal had been negotiating with the Taliban to build a pipeline, and the administration and the Taliban had actually come to Sugar Land, Texas, for a meeting.
This was, that's right.
This was back in the year 2001, during the early in the Bush administration, and George Bush then gave $46 or $47 million to the Taliban, ostensibly to stop growing opium. Tom DeLay was in the middle of all of that, and now we're seeing this merger, and the pipeline is now being built. Is anybody putting two and two together on
Nobody
that?
Nobody is dealing with that. I mean, it's much more, American people have a harder time dealing with things like tanker oils and stuff like that. Maybe your audience doesn't, but the average talk radio audience doesn't spend a lot of time on that.
Yeah.
They do spend a time on, if you're paying your wife, when you're only making $120,000 or $130,000 a year, actually he makes much more, and somebody's making another $100,000 a year, people get concerned.
Yeah. Well, and legitimately so. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks, Ellen. Great
to
hear from you. 29 minutes past the hour.
A party at Ed's house.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour.
The soft breathing
the girl.
Stepping on Simon and Garfunkel here.
She lies here beside
Welcome back. In just a moment, as promised, we're going to get to what George W. just revealed about Social Security. First, though, let's hear from Liz in Pennsylvania, been patiently waiting on the line. Hey, Liz, what's up?
Hi, Tom. A couple of your listeners during the last hour called in, and they were complaining about people griping and saying that they have a hard time getting anybody to take action. And I had an observation and a suggestion.
Okay.
The observation is that building group cohesion is a little bit like dating. You cannot sort of rush people into action before, you know, taking them to dinner and a movie and generally courting them.
Yeah.
And part of the courtship, at least in my experience, is letting people gripe. It's kind of a bonding thing. There are some people who will only ever gripe. But for a lot of people, it's part of building trust, building a relationship. And I think it's almost as important that people have a stake in you if you want them to do something as that they have a stake in the outcome of the action.
Right. Which gets back to my suggestion to, who was it? I believe it was James
Buddha?
In Houston or whoever it was. Yeah. That he actually step out and create an organization. You know.
Yes, and I have a suggestion for that. There's a website called www.drinkingliberally.com. And we have a group locally, and it started before the election with probably 12 people. It dwindled down to 5 because people were so depressed after the election. But we've got more than 30 people coming regularly now. And a group has formed, and now when one of us does something, we know we have backup.
Drinking?
Because people have stakes in each other.
Drinking liberally? Yeah, like
drinking liberally.
You get together and crack open a bottle of a beer or wine or something? Or
yes,
you meet at a bar or what?
Exactly. We meet at a local pub, and we have a meal, and we have lagers or whatever everybody likes to drink.
Yeah.
And it's a group of regulars at this point, and nobody misses it if they can possibly help it. And it's built a nice cohesive group.
That's great. Do you meet weekly or monthly?
Weekly, every Tuesday.
Every Tuesday. And is Drinking Liberally a site just for your group?
No, it's a site across the nation. There are Drinking Liberally groups breaking out everywhere because it's such an effective way to build group cohesion and to get people together. And frankly, because everybody needs to gripe at
that
this
is
point.
So cool. That is
yeah.
so cool. I'll have to check it out when I get off the air. Thank you.
Great.
Okay. Well, that's a good one. Liz, thank you. That was worth waiting for. I appreciate your phoning in with that. Thank you very much. And you have a great one. 24 minutes here before the hour. Now, back to George W. Bush and Social Security. This is absolutely remarkable. Now, let me just share with you this is the story. Of course, earlier in the week here, George W. Bush used a four-drawer, this is from the Associated Press, used a four-drawer filing cabinet stuffed with paper representing government IOUs that he said symbolized the Social Security Trust Fund's bleak outlook for meeting America's future retirement needs. And now I quote from George W. Bush, a lot of people in America think there is a trust that we take your money in payroll taxes and then we hold it for you and then when you retire we give it back to you, he said in a speech at the University of West Virginia at Parkersburg. But that's not the way it works, he said. There is no trust fund, just IOUs that I saw firsthand. Now, having read that, with any minimal level of information about how this whole thing works, you would have to come to the conclusion that either George W. Bush is incredibly stupid, and I don't think he is, or that this is one of the, it may end up being actually one of the most successful, who knows, one of the most sophisticated disinformation campaigns, lying campaigns that I have ever seen. First of all, he says, you think that the government takes your money and holds it for you until you retire. The fact of the matter is that up and from the time Social Security was created until around 1982, 83, in the early 80s, that's not how it worked. The way it worked was Social Security taxes came in, Social Security payments went out. And there was no trust fund. There was none. I mean, you know, they had a checking account, but they when you had more people retiring and fewer people working, or when the benefit levels went up because of inflation, the Social Security taxes got raised. They were raised in the 50s, they were raised in the 60s, they were raised in the 70s, and then in the early 80s, there was a huge raise. And this is a really significant milestone, a landmark, a huge change in the way that Social Security functioned. And, I'll bet you that 99 out of 100 Americans don't know this. They don't know that there was this commission that was put together while Ronald Reagan was president. And Dan Moynihan, Daniel Patrick Moynihan was on it, and Alan Greenspan was on it. The two of them were kind of the two heads of it. It was a bipartisan commission to look into what to do. Because up until that point, from its inception in the 1930s up until the 1980s, Social Security had always been basically on a pay-as-you-go basis. That is, if they knew that they had to pay out $200 billion in benefits that year, then they made sure that the tax rate was adjusted to 4.03% or whatever, so that they brought in $200 billion. But then they looked down the road, and they saw that after World War II, there were all these GIs who came home, and they'd been away from home for a couple of years, and they were mighty, mighty lonely and mighty happy to see their wives. And there were these incentives for getting married and going to college, you know, the GI Bill and getting a home. And so there was this population explosion that happened that started around 46, 47 and kind of petered out in the mid to late 50s. And so you got this bulge, this demographic bulge, this big bunch of people who got born, the baby boomers, okay, appropriately named, I suppose. And they looked down the road and they said, when the baby boomers start to retire, we're going to have to raise the Social Security tax up to around 17, 18, 19% from its current, now in 82, as I recall, it was around 8%, from its current 8%. And that's going to be a real hard pill to swallow, that sudden increase in the Social Security tax. And it's going to slow down the economy. I mean, there's a lot of good reasons not to do sudden tax increases where they don't produce a sudden spending boom. Now, on the other hand, if you suddenly raise taxes to build highways, you're generating jobs, you're enhancing commerce. You'll actually see a return very quickly on that. But if you're suddenly raising taxes simply to pay, well, in any case, they say, we don't want to do this. So what we're going to do is we're going to raise the Social Security tax all the way up to 12.6% or thereabouts. I believe it's 12.6%, maybe it's 12.2, whatever it is. We're going to raise it up to this level right now in 82 or 83. And it's going to start bringing in more money than it needs. And we're going to start saving that money. We're going to put that money in a savings account, and that's going to be called the Social Security Trust Fund. There had never been a Social Security Trust Fund before that. And that money is going to be there simply to pay for the baby boomers. And once the baby boomers die off in 2050 and 2060, they'll all be gone by that time. And we'll be back to a position where we can go back to pay as you go. So the Social Security Trust Fund was really just to pay that extra expense of that extra demographic bulge of the baby boomers. Everybody understood that. So what happened then was 83 came along, 84 came along. Ronald Reagan was running for re-election. And there were these parallel events happening. You had the Star of the Beast conservatives, the ones who wanted there to be smaller government. They thought that things like Social Security and Medicare and welfare and unemployment benefits, that these were all socialism and that you shouldn't have these, that people should simply stand on their own two feet, right? That sort of thing. And that's a reasonable philosophy that has a long tradition in America. It goes all the way back to Alexander Hamilton and John Adams. And so, but they knew that the 80% of Americans didn't agree with them. Only about 20% of Americans would say, okay, let's do away with Social Security. Let's do away with unemployment benefits. Let's do away with federal support for housing. Let's do away with, the Federal Home Loan Board. Let's do away with the veterans benefits, all that socialist stuff. Let's get rid of it. Only a small percentage of Americans would agree with that. So they had to essentially fool people. And the way to fool people is to create a crisis. They would create the crisis by reducing taxes so that the government goes into the red. And then you run around going, oh, my God, the government's in the red. We're running out of money. We've got to cut these programs. We can't afford them. And so they did that. And so Reagan threw the country into a massive deficit. Before he came into office, we had never had a deficit higher than $1 trillion. In the first 4 years of his presidency, Ronald Reagan ran up more debt than every president from George Washington to Ronald Reagan had combined in real dollars. So they created this disaster, and it was looking really bad. And in fact, it was such a debt disaster that that David Stockman and these guys, you know, in the Reagan administration, they looked around and they said, you know, if we tell people how bad we've really made it with these huge tax cuts for the millionaires and billionaires and with this massive increase in spending for this Star Wars defense program, that basically was all R&D, you know, it was all going to the corporations that had basically put Reagan into power. He said, if we tell people how bad this really is, it might shake the bond market. It might actually harm the ability of our government to borrow money. And we've got to borrow money to keep doing this. And so they took some of that money. They took actually all of that money in the Social Security Trust Fund, that money that was being saved for the baby boomers to retire on. They took that money and they borrowed it and put it into the general fund. And so they borrowed the first year, they borrowed $60, $70 billion. They put it into the general fund. Last year, they borrowed about $200 billion. Yeah, but the first year, as I recall, was around $60 or $70 billion. They put it in the general fund, and they said, and so the deficit is not $270 billion. It's only $200 billion, or whatever it was, whatever the numbers were back then. And so they were able to understate the amount of the deficit by borrowing from the Social Security Trust Fund, because that's the government borrowing from itself, and so they figured they didn't have to report that as a deficit. And, follow along with this. This is really important. I know it sounds a little complicated, but it's and what has happened is every president since then, including Clinton, continued to borrow from the Social Security Trust Fund and put that money into the general fund, that is, into the total operating fund out of which they pay the Pentagon and out of which they pay government employees' salaries and out of which they pay for roads and air traffic control and you know, all the things that government does, right? They borrowed from the Social Security Fund. Now, what did they give the Social Security Fund in exchange for borrowing that money? They gave them an IOU. The IOUs were called Treasury Bonds and Treasury Bills, T-bills and T-bonds. To shorten it, treasuries. Now, at the same time, we're having to borrow trillions of dollars from wealthy people in the United States and from people all over the world just to keep the country solvent, just to be able to pay the bills. Because ever since Reagan, we've been running these massive deficits. And the only way that you can continue to operate the government, if you don't bring in enough money in taxes to pay the bills, is to borrow that money. And we've been borrowing that money by issuing the exact same treasuries. So China's holding our treasuries. Japan is holding our treasuries. Saudi Arabia is holding our treasuries. All over the world, there are countries that are holding our treasuries. There are stock funds that are invested in our treasuries. Pension funds are invested in our treasuries. Wealthy people in America, the Bush family owns millions of dollars in treasuries. And the and the Social Security Trust Fund is sitting on about 1.7 trillion dollars in treasury bonds. Now, what that means is that in 2012, when we have to start taking that leftover money, that extra money that we started accumulating back in 82, 83. When we have to start taking that leftover money and paying it out to people, the Social Security Administration, Social Security Trust Fund, in order to pay that money out in benefits, is going to have to take those treasury bills to the United States Treasury and say, here's our treasury bond, please give us the cash. And when they do that, our government is suddenly going to have to say, we don't have the cash. We're going to have to raise taxes or cut spending, because for 25 years now, 23 years basically, Reagan, Bush Sr., Clinton, and Bush Jr. have all gotten a pass on this thing. They've all been spending that Social Security Trust Fund and leaving behind IOUs. The IOUs are called Treasury Bonds. Now, here's the downside. If we default on those, if we say, oh, these bonds are worthless, then the whole world is going to say, your treasury bonds are worthless? We're not going to loan you any more money. And the United States will be in a depression that will make the Great Depression look like an absolute frigging picnic. And so now, understanding that as you do, now listen to what George W. Bush said when he pulled out these Treasury notes. I mean, just go back to this story again. President Bush on Tuesday used a four-drawer filing cabinet stuffed with paper representing government IOUs, that's Treasury bonds, that he said symbolized the Social Security's trust fund's bleak outlook for meeting America's future retirement needs. This is the AP story. And I quote George W. Bush, "A lot of people in America think there is a trust, that we take your money in payroll taxes and then we hold it for you, and then when you retire we give it back to you. But that's not the way it works. There is no trust fund, just IOUs that I saw firsthand." And then he opens a drawer and shows the IOUs, the Treasury bonds. And he says, "This is it. This is what exists," Bush said, illustrating his point that the promise of future Social Security benefits are simply stashed in a file. Susan Chapman, who is with the Office of Public Debt Accounting, was with him. She opened the second drawer and pulled out a white notebook filled with pseudo-Treasury certificates, securities, pieces of paper that offer physical evidence of the $1.7 trillion in Treasury bonds that make up the trust fund. The pieces of paper that Bush saw are not real treasuries, by the way, because everything is done on computers nowadays. So imagine, Bush says, the retirement security for future generations is sitting in a filing cabinet. Well, imagine, George, you've got to pay that money back. You're in charge of the government. You generate the budget. What are you going to do? Well, what he's trying to do is he's trying to change the subject. And that's no way to run a government. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush Show, Brush Lintball,
to tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I don't want millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Won't you give me back my job again?
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 4 minutes before the hour, four and a half before the hour. Once again, just to make this absolutely clear, you have to understand this. The Social Security Trust Fund is not the Social Security system. It's a special bank account of extra money, of surplus money, that they started accumulating in 1982 or 83. And this was these were the reforms that came out of the Moynihan-Greenspan Commission that Ronald Reagan signed into, and they increased the Social Security tax at that time in order to set aside money that could be used to pay for the baby boomers retiring. And when that Social Security Trust Fund is exhausted, when it's all gone, it's supposed to go away. It's supposed to go away. And Social Security, because that's when the baby boomers have died off, and Social Security is supposed to go back to being a system like it was from its creation up until 1982 or 83. It's supposed to go back to a system of paying as it goes. Whatever it spends out that year, that's what it taxes that year. And in fact, if the economy grows over the next 75 years at exactly the same rate it has the last 75 years, including the Great Depression, there will be no problem whatsoever. All of the projections that are being made right now are being made on the assumption that the Bush recession, this recession of the last 4 years, is going to continue on forever. Except for the projections of how much money you'll make if you put your money in a private account. All those projections assume that the economy for the next 75 years is going to do as well as it did during Clinton's presidency. Do you get how we're being lied to and manipulated here? I mean, it's epic proportions. It's truly mind-boggling. Imagine, Bush said in his speech, the retirement security for future generations is sitting in a filing cabinet. It's time to strengthen and modernize Social Security. You can tell Frank Luntz focus grouped those words. For future generations with growing assets that you can control and you can call your own, assets the government can't take away. All the magic buzzwords. And what's it going to do? It's going to add $4 trillion more dollars of debt. Right now, Social Security is sitting on $1.7 trillion surplus. And it's growing. except that last year George spent $212 billion of it and didn't tell us, in fact, reduced his budget deficit by that amount, pretended it wasn't there. We got to wake folks up here. It is time to awaken and take back the country. This is Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
How can there be hope?
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. The chat room, if you want to drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com will get you there. Click live chat. It'll take you into our message board area. You'll find 50, 60,000 messages and thousands of people from literally every continent on earth participating. Click live chat there, and it'll take you to the chat room where you can just drop in and say hi in real time. By the way, if you're listening to this program on Friday, it's a repeat of Wednesday's program because I am on an airplane flying from Vermont to Oregon, where Louise and I are relocating. But the program will continue, and on Monday we'll be back on the air, simply from a new studio. And if you're listening to the program on Wednesday, which is today as I'm speaking right now, I'm here. So the number is 1-866-889-8894. Feel free to give us a shout. I want to get back to this issue of the economy, because this is the thing that, on the one hand, offers the greatest hope for us. This is the engine that drives America. This is the thing that touches the most families in the most meaningful and significant ways. And it is the thing that represents the greatest threat to us. The damage that has been done to our economy, basically since 1980. If you go back and you look at the history of the American economy, you see that from the time that we came out of Hoover's Great Depression, you know, the country went into the Great Depression. Herbert Hoover in 1928 was reelected with either the largest or the second largest majority of any sitting president in history. And, you know, everybody just thought this was just great what he was doing. Tax cuts for the rich, the laissez-faire economics. The Supreme Court had ruled that minimum wage laws were illegal. Child labor laws were illegal. The unions were routinely being busted. People who wanted to unionize were being shot. Private security forces were being formed. Pinkerton started out this way as a private army, basically. And many of them were being used to bust up union activity, in some cases in ways that were, beyond violent, shall we say. So Hoover got reelected in 28 and 29. The bubble burst. The bubble, by the way, what's really interesting about the bubble of the 1920s is that it was fueled by debt. In the 19-teens, radio happened. And the Radio Corporation of America, RCA, started the first radio station, they started the first radio network, and they were also manufacturing radios. And they were the first, up until that point in time in America, for the previous 150 years of American history, basically, if you want to buy something, you saved up your money until you were ready to afford to buy it. And that's why very few people owned their homes. Only about 20-25% of Americans actually owned their homes at that time. And the majority of them were farmers, small farmers, all across the United States. Keep in mind, this was before the great mergers and acquisitions of the 80s, when Reagan stopped suspending the Sherman antitrust law, and in the agriculture field, the giant corporations basically, you know, colluded to drive the small family farm out of business, and you had Willie Nelson out there as the sole guy trying to hold it off and he wasn't particularly successful. You got a lot of farmers in America now still working in the farms that have been in their families for generations, but they no longer own them. They're now owned by one of four major multinational corporations that own most of the farmland in the United States. But in any case, you had a very small number of people owned their homes, and people saved up their money, and then they would buy something and pay cash for it. And RCA, starting in the early 20s, wanted to propagate radio. I mean, radio was the hot thing. Everybody wanted to have a radio. It was the internet of its day. And so RCA started offering credit. You can buy a radio and you can pay it off over a two-year period. And I don't know what the interest rates were, but very low, if there was even interest at all. I don't recall. But they offered this program where you could buy a radio and pay for it on time. And they went into the business of basically financing radios. And it became a huge fad. And people all across the country started doing it and going into debt to do it. And this caused RCA's stock to double and then double again and then double again and double again. It was like Microsoft. It was the Microsoft of its day. And the RCA stock was just going through the roof, just absolutely exploding throughout the 20s. And not just RCA. RCA plus any company that had anything to do with radio. There were the companies that manufactured the capacitors. There were the companies that manufactured the inductors. There were the companies that manufactured the vacuum tubes. There were the companies that competed with RCA, that made other radios, you know, different types of radios. There were dozens of radio manufacturers then. There were the companies that were broadcasting radio signals, the radio stations. There were the radio networks. All of them were getting into the stock market. And you had a stock market that in the 1920s absolutely exploded, you know, just blew out of proportion as a result of radio. And just like the internet and computing did in the 1990s. The difference being that back then you could buy stock on margin. You could buy stock by putting down 10%. So if you wanted to buy $100 worth of stock, all you had to have was $10 in your pocket. And so taxi drivers were getting into the business. I remember Gloria Swanson was on the board of the New England Salem Children's Village, this community for abused kids that Louise and I started back in 1973 in New Hampshire. And I used to go to New York, and we would have dinner together and at her apartment. She had been a vegetarian since 1929, as I recall. And I remember her telling me this story that Joe Kennedy told her. She said that Joe Kennedy said to her, and this was just before the Great Crash, and he was managing her at that time, by the way. He was managing her career. And according to her, he ripped her off. That's a whole other story. You can read her autobiography, Swanson on Swanson. But in any case, she said Joe Kennedy one day made the remark, when the taxi drivers are giving you stock tips, then you know it's time to get out of the stock market. And he, of course, hadn't just said that to Gloria Swanson. It's a rather famous saying, and it's been attributed to a bunch of different people. But she told me, this is the first time I heard it. This was 30 years ago, and she told me this story. It was in 1980, and 25 years ago. And so anyhow, everybody was getting into the stock market on margin because it looked like it could only go up. And the bubble burst in October of 1929. And the margin calls came in, and people couldn't make their margin calls, and people couldn't pay for their radios, their time payments on the radios, and other things had been started to being offered. You know, consumer credit was starting to take off in the late 20s, starting around 25, 26, and a lot of retailers were starting to offer consumer credit. Sears was starting to offer consumer credit, and nobody could pay anything, and it just spiraled. It just went into an absolute nosedive, the economy. And because America was one of the industrial powerhouses of the world, it took the rest of the world economy with it. So we finally climbed out of that. Roosevelt figured out that if to jumpstart the economy, he had to get money into the hands of average working people. That you give money to millionaires and billionaires, and they'll stash it in a Swiss bank account, or they'll put it in Swiss francs or something. They'll place it someplace secure, but they're not necessarily going to open a factory, because you don't, you know, if you've got a lot of money, you don't just open a factory for fun, and you don't do it to employ people. This whole idea of creating jobs is silly. If there is demand for a product, entrepreneurs and businesses will step in and they'll say, we'll make that product. And, of course, then they need to hire somebody to make it. But it's not like they're creating jobs. It's like demand is creating a demand for the product. The demand for the product is the thing that drives the business, and then the business, you know, of course, hires people. So Roosevelt figured out that instead of simply giving all that money to the very wealthiest among us, if he could figure out a way to give money to the very poorest Americans, they would spend all of it, and that would create demand for products and services. And that demand for products and services would be met by small businesses, and they would grow, and they would hire people, and now people would have a job, and pretty soon you could stop paying people essentially out of tax money because you'd have an economy back. And so he created the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, and the CCC, and all these, you know, all these acronyms, which were basically make work projects. I mean, they didn't want to just give money to people. And the reality was that there were a lot of things that needed desperately to be done, just like now. The infrastructure of America is crumbling right now. Our bridges, our roads, our water systems, our sewage systems are in terrible shape throughout most of this country. Not according to me. I mean, according to, like, the American Society of Engineers. They just gave our infrastructure a D- about 2 months ago. This is their annual report card. Said it's just about as bad as it was in the late 20s because nobody had been spending money on it. Because the government was saying, hey, you know, we're not, big government's a bad thing. We're not supposed to be spending the taxpayers' money. We're just giving tax cuts. And so they're not taking care of the business of government. So Roosevelt made government the employer of last resort. If you're unemployed, we'll find something for you to do. There are forests that need to be planted. There are bridges that needed to be built. There were roads that needed to be built. There were buildings that needed to be built. For those people who were not, you know, builders, there was artwork that needed to be done. There was writing that needed to be done. Some of those, you know, Sinclair Lewis, I mean, some of the finest writers of our time, or of that time, were able to write because they got grants from the WPA or the other affiliated organizations. Well, now we're seeing a very, very similar time. The debt that the average American is in has now reached the proportions that it reached in 1929. The disparity between wealth and poverty in America has reached, for the first time, the same ratios that it was back in 1929 when the market blew out. And the middle class is being wiped out again, just like it was in the 1920s. In the 1920s, from about 1880 to the 1930s, to the Great Depression, there really wasn't much of a middle class. Most people rented. Most people were living paycheck to paycheck. Most people were what today would be called the working poor. The average wage in the bottom 90% of Americans was under $10,000 a year in today's dollars. That's what people were living on. Now, people were living much more simply. They weren't flying around the country on vacations, and they weren't going to sandals in Jamaica, and they didn't have two cars. They lived much more simply. But that's still, I mean, a lot of people just kind of skating by on the edge. And Roosevelt fixed this thing, and we went into the golden age of the American middle class from the late 1930s, early 1940s, right up until Ronald Reagan became president and reversed the process. And Reagan, with supply-side economics and the Lafler curve, just said, oh, all that stuff that Roosevelt did, that's all wrong. That's socialism. That's terrible. We've got to undo all that stuff. And so now what do we have? We have massive debt, massive government debt. Our jobs have been outsourced overseas. Our government is in debt. Our individual families are in debt. And the bubble is fixing to burst again, I am afraid. We'll see.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really...
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
It's the No Boring Zone. Here with Tom Hartman. The Economic Policy Institute just published a report titled The State of Working America 2004/2005. And this is something everybody should read. This is really quite a remarkable document. They point out, and I quote, the 2001 downturn stopped and even reversed most of the positive economic trends that characterized the latter 1990s. This, by the way, started long before 9/11 and started after the election. This was the direct result of Bush reinstituting trickle-down economics, going back to Reaganomics. They point out that there was this golden age of the American middle class that ran from the late 30s, early 40s, up until more or less when Reagan came into office. And they point out that there was a steady relationship between productivity and the income of the average working family in America throughout that period, from the 30s through the 70s. That when workers became more productive, they made more money. Their employers shared more with them, and, you know, makes sense, right? Yet, starting in the mid-70s, they say this lockstep relationship broke down. And from the mid-70s until 2002, median family income grew at about one-third the rate of productivity instead of 100% of the rate of productivity. In fact, they say using newly available income data that goes all the way back to 1913, income in 2000 was only slightly less concentrated among the top 1% of households than during the run-up to the Great Depression, which was the worst period of uneven income concentration in the last century. See, it's not about, having, Bill Gates be a billionaire is a bad thing or anything like that. It's like there are certain laws and rules of economics that you just can't avoid, that when the concentration of wealth reaches a certain level, it almost hits a tipping point and things are like ready to fall over. Well, if the working people of America didn't benefit from this increase in productivity, who did? Well, the report said those at the top of the economic scale claimed most of the income growth. As you see, during the top 1%. And in real dollars, median household income has declined. This from an op-ed piece in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer by Mark Trahant. He says the effects is in the shrinking paycheck of median household incomes. In real dollars, the median household income has declined $971 in 2001, $502 in 2002, and $63 in 2003, a cumulative loss of $1,536. Health insurance has declined for all wage groups, and pension coverage is shrinking too, down from more than half of all workers in 1979 to 45% in 2002. Over a third of us have mortgages that are based on adjustable rates. We're at the mercy of interest rates. Now, the report, this report from the Economic Policy Institute, does note that there is some positive news. Some people have benefited from this, quoting from the report, quote, from 1979 to 2000, yeah, this is basically from the year, from Reagan until 2000. The wage of the median chief executive officer grew 79%, and average compensation grew 342%. USA Today last week reported among the 100 largest companies in America, $14 million for the average CEO, up 25% from the year before, and the average salary up 5% to $1.1 million. As the editorialist for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer notes, Mark Trahant, he says, there you go, more proof that the Bush tax cuts are working for the top 1%, which, of course, is Bush and his friends. But the average American, we're out of luck. We'll take some phone calls on this right after this break. Our number, 1-866-889-8894. Hear what you're thinking on these topics. 29 minutes past the hour.
And now for a traffic update, we go to Kelly Clark.
Bringing the democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Come all you good workers, good news to you I'll tell of how the good old union has come in here to dwell.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
Oh, I try to sing along, but I did that once on this program, and I got so many emails from people saying, don't you ever sing on the radio again, that I took an oath. So anyway, Joan Baez, incredible. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, Jay in Arcata, California on the line. Hey, Jay, what's up today?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind, Jay?
Well, first, I want to thank you for being a breath of fresh air, but the parallel you're drawing to the 20s is a little frightening because after the Depression, we got ourselves out of it by, like you say, giving working people money and letting them buy things. But we don't make anything anymore.
I know.
So the government could give everybody jobs, and they'd have to spend their money on Chinese goods. I mean, it's not going to work.
Well, actually, it can work. The one thing that Herbert Hoover did right in 1930, a year after the Great Depression, was he pushed through the Smoot-Hawley legislation. And Smoot-Hawley increased our tariffs. And there are those who say Smoot-Hawley prolonged the Great Depression, and it's possible that it did. There's some very, very good discussions of this out on the web that you can probably find with a Google search without much. Type in cause of the Great Depression, and there's a brilliant piece, a very thoughtful, very insightful piece done by an economics student. I forget where. It's been a year or so since I've read it. That's just really lays this out in tremendous detail. But basically, what Smoot-Hawley did was raise the protectionist barriers. And the whole goal of it that Hoover, the Republican, was trying to do was to try and create the circulation of money, to increase the circulation of money within the United States so that we were buying less from outside the United States
to encourage the
development.
To protect.
Right.
There is no steel industry. We don't make computers, we don't make pots. You can't even buy a pressure cooker made in this country.
You're absolutely right, and a lot of that was true in the 1920s as well. And what Smoot-Hawley did was, throughout the 30s and the 40s, led to the reindustrialization of the United States. And we had prior to the 1890s, which is when we went into this kind of free trade mania, and Hoover pulled us back from it in 1930 with Smoot-Hawley. Prior to that time, we had pretty much made everything in the United States that we used in the United States. And in the 1880s, 1890s, with the Gilded Age and wealth being viewed as a tremendous gift, a sign of a divine, God patting you on the head and saying you're a good one, divine approval, that everybody wanted to emulate the wealthy, and imported goods became, quite the thing to have. And so imports were increasing steadily from the 1880s up until 1930, up until Smoot-Hawley.
Were they like what they are today?
Well, no, they weren't. They weren't anything close to where they are today. We're only producing 16% of what we consume right now. Back then, I don't remember the numbers, frankly, but it was probably something like 70 or 80%. But nonetheless, the point is that don't underestimate the resiliency of this country and of its people and of our people and of our economy. It is incredibly resilient. If we were to slide into a Great Depression, or if we were to simply just, it were to be a real serious crisis, and I'm expecting that there probably will be one within the next, at the most, 5 to 10 years. If we were to slide into that, and if our government responds appropriately by doing essentially what Hoover did, increase taxes to the point where government is actually paying as it goes rather than having to borrow from the rest of the world, so we don't get into the inflationary spiral that the Weimar Republic got into, number one. Number two, becomes the employer of last resort with things like the WPA, starts putting people back to work immediately, and we certainly have the need for it on our infrastructure and things like that. And number three, puts back into place I'm reluctant to call it protectionist legislation. Because
why not? That's not a bad word.
Well, see, that's the thing. A lot of people think it's a bad word. I don't think it's a bad word either. Puts back into play. And by the way, on the other side, who agrees with me on this is Pat Buchanan, of all people. But in any case, puts back into place legislation that raises the tariffs. And frankly, we don't even have to put that stuff back into place. All we have to do is walk away from a couple of treaties. And one of the great things that George W. Bush taught us in his first few weeks in office is that we don't need no stinking treaties. I mean, he walked away from the anti-ballistic missile treaty. He just said, hey, I'm not going to do it. Kyoto Accord, hey, Clinton signed it. I'm unsigning it. I mean, it's that simple. And we could walk away from WTO. We could walk away from GATT. We can walk away from NAFTA. We could walk away from CAFTA if it gets passed. Frankly, I'm beginning to think it won't, because the rest of the, you know, certainly down in Central America, they're waking up. We could walk away from those things and put up protectionist barriers that will bring back into the United States the incentive for companies in this country to do business in this country. The only barrier to that, the only thing that's preventing that right now, even, is the widespread and pervasive control of the media and the stories that we're all hearing and the news that we're all hearing by multinational corporations that make as much money outside the United States as they do inside the United States. And so they have an interest in simply making a profit, whether or not it benefits America and Americans. And you know, you just can't get around that. And these are the people who have bought and sold, people like Tom DeLay and Bill Frist. And eventually, if things get really bad, particularly very quickly, I'm guessing that Americans are going to wake up and they're going to say, hey, you know, we don't need these multinationals. We don't want to be run by them. We don't want to have government of, by, and for the multinationals anymore. Jay, I got to move along. But
yeah,
thanks.
Keep spreading the word, Tom.
You're it, Jay. you too. I appreciate the call. 1-866-889-8894. Vince in Illinois on the line. Hey, Vince, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Big fan. Matter of fact, last night I just flew in from Phoenix, and I had to rearrange my luggage because I had so many of your books in one pack that it took me over 50 pounds, so I had to take them and spread them all out.
Bless you. My publishers, thank you, Vince.
It's okay. Yeah, I know you're not getting rich at it, but...
No, I make about 10 cents a book.
I spread the word everywhere
helps.
I go.
Yeah, thank you.
This, I think, ties into the economic discussion. Yet one more chink in the neocon logic chain. There's so much for free market capitalism and entrepreneurialism, yet I wonder if they've ever considered that how much a no national health plan impedes the creation of entrepreneurs.
Oh, absolutely. It is one of the big obstacles, and not only at the small level, not only at the level of a small business that likes to start out, you know, that wants to start out. There's a lot of small entrepreneurs that would love to be able to offer health care. They just can't afford it. But even at the large level, General Motors, I think it was about a year ago, I heard this statistic that $6,500 of the cost of a car, maybe I'm wrong on that number, but it's more than the cost of the steel in that car, is the cost of just health care for the employees who are putting it together. Now, that's a significant impediment to business. And those folks who say, oh, you raise taxes, you're going to put a drag on business, hey, you want to solve that problem. Let's go back to a healthcare system in the United States that's a not-for-profit healthcare system, where hospitals have to be not-for-profit corporations, where health insurance companies have to be not-for-profit, or even better, let's do away with health insurance companies and let's simply make Medicare universal.
Right.
We already have a single-payer healthcare system in the United States. It's called Medicare. Let's make it available to everybody.
Yeah, I totally agree. But it's funny how I've never heard that ever come up very much, how there are so many people who would like to strike out on their own, me being one of them, and I tried it but couldn't hang in long enough, you know, had to go back to work for the corporation just to keep my family protected.
Yeah, no, I've been there. I mean, I've been an entrepreneur most of my life, but I remember in 1978 when Louise got pregnant with our first child, I went to work for RCA as an engineer just to get the health insurance.
Right.
Because,
right.
You know, we had a baby coming. It was our first kid, I ran my own business and I couldn't provide myself with health insurance.
Well, I think the whole insurance thing has kind of been on tilt for a long time, because it actually drove me out of my original profession, which was a musician.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, I played your fair city at one time, Burlington.
Oh, great.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
But, you know, when my insurance and premiums got up to $800 a month, because I guess the company, I won't say their name, but they're built like a rock.
Yeah.
You know, no longer, I just decided that particular plan I had was profitable for them, so they just, they have this formula and they keep raising the rates.
Yeah, well, that's what they do, and I mean, that's what they're incorporated to do. It's not like there's like evil companies. I mean, they're playing the game by the rules. The thing is, we make the rules.
Well, you know, and I gotta, wonder about these rules, because the way it worked was they can raise the rate so much across the board statewide. Well, everybody who's healthy jumps out of the policy, who has a spouse.
And then the insurance company's in a problem. And this is another reason to make Medicare universal. Yeah. Vince, I got to move along. I appreciate the call, though. Good to hear from you. Thank you very much. Alice in Humboldt County, California on the line. Hey, Alice, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Alice.
Afternoon, I guess.
Yes, it is.
Bill Clinton may have borrowed some from Social Security early, but if my memory is correct, he returned it and left quite a good surplus.
Well,
Al Gore wanted to put it in a lockbox.
Yes.
So that they couldn't do what Bush has done.
Yeah, Al Gore was fanatic about saying that there should be a lockbox for the Social Security Trust Fund. And it may be that in the last year or two of the Clinton administration, when they actually were generating surpluses, that they were no longer borrowing from the Social Security Trust Fund. My understanding, my recollection, and it's 6 years old, and may be wrong, I'll go back and check, was that that surplus that Bill Clinton had was actually overstated, because he was still considering the Social Security income as part of general funds, because there was no lockbox. And that was the argument that Al Gore was making, was that we need to account for it separately, in part because the Clinton administration was doing it too. Not out of some evil Machiavellian thing. It was just the way the government did their accounting, So, but I'll find out, Alice. I'll find out. You may well be right, and if so,
I'm sure I am.
Oh, okay. Well, I would love to stand corrected on that. And if anybody can point me to that resource, maybe somebody in the chat room can find it quickly on the web and let us know. Thank you, Alice, for that. Thank you.
Okay. Have a good day.
You too, Alice. Have a great one. G in Edward, Pennsylvania, or G is it G Edward in Pennsylvania?
Yes.
Hey, G Edward, what's up?
Yes. Hi. I called a few times before. I want to talk about the voter fraud.
Yes, sir.
I think we're doing this entirely wrong.
Doing what entirely?
The whole trying to stop the fraud. You see, if we had a rapist running around, would we pass chastity belts out to all the women?
No.
No, we would catch the criminals. That's what we should do. And we're not doing that.
I know. I agree with you. And as long as the House is controlled by Denny Hastert and Tom DeLay, and the Senate is controlled by Bill Frist, and the White House is controlled by George W. Bush, and the Supreme Court is controlled by Scalia, you're not going to have any significant or meaningful investigation into the criminals who are, into any crimes that may have been committed vis-a-vis the voting machines.
Not necessarily.
Look at what they're trying to do in Ohio. You have four lawyers who simply raised the question, and they got slapped down with a lawsuit by the power of the entire state of Ohio came down on them.
Well, I think we should do it here in Pennsylvania. What we should do is start calling the governor and ask him to stop either the traitors or the terrorists. They may be terrorists running these voting machines, too.
Yeah, well, G. Edward, have you made that call?
Yes. In fact, I put it on my website. I'm running for Senate against Rick Santorum in 2000.
Oh, great.
I called you before about the...
Yes, and your website is?
GEdwardCook.com.
COOK?
Yes.
GEdwardCook.com. Great, okay. And people can find out about that. And by the way, if you want to call your member of Congress... The number is 1-877, that's the toll-free number, 877-SOB-U, the letter U, S-O-B. And that will get you to any member of Congress or the House of Representatives or the Senate. And you can raise these issues. And I think it's an important
well, we can get around the federal thing by calling the governor, because the governor has a lot more power. I mean, he's really the second most powerful person in the country.
Yeah, and not just the governor. You know, it's interesting. Here in Vermont, we had in Montpelier, in this little town that I live in, we had a get-together that was put together by a local activist, for lack of a better word, just a guy who was concerned about electronic voting. This is about a year and a half ago. And he invited me to speak, and he invited a guy from one of the universities nearby who was a professor of statistics and computer science to speak. And he invited the Secretary of State, Deb Markowitz, who's a very decent Democrat, very decent person, a nice person. And Deb, at that point, believed that there was no problem. She had been to the presentations that Diebold had made, and she was like, oh, these people, they know what they're doing, and they've got it all under control, and there's nothing to worry about. And it really wasn't that much of an issue for Vermont anyway, because we don't have voting machines here. We have, we do it by paper. But in any case, she showed up. And it was in the local Unitarian Church basement, and it was in the dead of winter. It was like in January, and it was like 15 below zero, and there's a 10-mile-an-hour. I remember walking down there getting frostbite. It was just a horrible night. And I showed up for this thing thinking, you know, it's going to be, you know, me and these two speakers and Deb and maybe three people. There was standing room only. There must have been 200-300 people in the basement of that church. And people stood up and they started yelling at her, and because as soon as Deb said, "Oh, I don't think that there's any problem here," that crowd was ready to take her apart. And I'm the one who had to say, "Now, you guys calm down for a minute. We need to educate her about this." And so we went through, and people told their stories, and the professor, you know, told statistics, told about how easy it was to hack into these machines. And we had people who had brought documentation, and we shared it with her. And by the end of that evening, an hour and a half later, we had the Secretary of State of the state of Vermont saying, "You know, this could be a real problem. I need to learn more about this." And ever since then, she has been very aggressive and very proactive in making sure that these problems are addressed. And for me, that was just an incredible experience. So don't overlook your Secretary of State. That's actually the official who makes the decisions about the voting machines, not the governor. It's the Secretary of State. So go for it, G. Edward.
Thank you.
Anyhow, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. And good luck on your candidacy. GEdwardCook.com. People can check it out. Medicare may raise seniors' premiums 12% in 2006. Did you catch this? This is in Bloomberg News. At the same time, that George W. Bush is proposing that in order to privatize Social Security, we should cut benefits and raise Social Security taxes and or raise the taxes, and that he's unwilling to raise the taxes, so we should cut Social Security benefits. At that same time, the Medicare, which is providing health care to 41 million elderly and disabled Americans, the Medicare premiums are going up 12% next year. 12%. That's a 49% increase over the previous 3 years, over the last 3 years. 49% increase, hitting those who can afford it the least. But we got to pay for tax cuts for billionaires, you know? 10 minutes before the hour. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. With the continuing erosion of the middle class and the separation between...
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And who's gonna pay the bill? Who's gonna pay the bill? Not Rush Limbaugh, not George Will, not those chicken hawks on Capitol Hill, not the tax cut billionaires. You know the drill. You're gonna pay the bill.
And it turns out, while Social Security's trust fund will start being used in 2012 and will be exhausted in 2042, although Social Security will continue after that, Medicare actually ran into the red last year. Last year. Right now, Medicare is operating in the red. You want a crisis? 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, 5 minutes before the hour. Nancy in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Nancy.
Hey. Yeah, I just wanted to point out that Medicare already went up 17% this year.
Yeah.
And they're deducting that from our Social Security, so that even though Social Security went up...
2.7% last year.
Right. Yeah. By the time you take out Medicare raise, and then didn't get a 2.7.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, Medicare went up 17.4% in 2005, 13.5% in 2004, whereas Social Security went up 2.7% in 2004 and 2% in 2005. And they're projecting 2.2% for this year. Social Security. But that 12% increase in Medicare is going to whack right out of it.
Yeah, and so, yes, Social Security is in trouble, but it's Medicare that's destroying it.
It's Medicare that's eating it alive. Now, and therein lies a real crisis. Why is nobody talking about that?
I can't imagine.
Could it be because they re-engineered Medicare last year so that $300 billion a year would end up going to the pharmaceutical companies at full retail for their name brand drugs, because they said that the Medicare system can't negotiate drug prices, and they just want to milk it until there's nothing left before they declare a crisis?
What I really can't imagine either is why George Bush is going around saying that we people that are already on Social Security don't have anything to worry about.
Yeah.
I didn't start worrying until he said that.
Yeah, well, you know, if I was living on Social Security and my Medicare premiums were going up, and therefore my Social Security checks were going down while inflation is going up, and particularly with government borrowing like crazy to pay for tax cuts for billionaires, thus driving up interest rates, thus driving down the value of the dollar, thus driving up the price of everything all around me, I would be concerned. I would be very concerned. And I think that Americans have, you know, good, legitimate right and reason to be concerned about the existence, about the solvency of Social Security. And the reality is that George W. Bush has not put one, the Republicans in general, have not put one proposal forward that would address the issue of solvency, that is the amount of money in the Social Security system. All they've done is say they want to privatize it. And they have been saying that since 1936, when Social Security was passed without a single Republican vote over the objection of the Republicans by Roosevelt and the Democrats. And they've been opposed to it ever since. Nancy, thanks for the call.
Okay.
It's great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. And thanks for being with us today. Thanks to Ira Gravatt for the wonderful job he has done, line engineering, line producing our program. This last year here, it's just been absolutely great. Ira, thank you so much. You've been wonderful. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks to Louise for producing our program, to Rama for all the help he's given us, to Jay for our music, and to our sponsors, of course. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Vivil Nikraskin. I'm the president.